Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
The Anne Frank Diaries, written by a 13-year-old in hiding with her family from the Nazis in Holland, is for many of us one of the most potent portals into life as a Jew during World War II. In fact, there are over a million visitors to the Anne Frank Museum in Amsterdam every year. But for those of us who may never get there, the life of Anne and her family has now come to Australia in a travelling exhibition. The chairman of the exhibition, Boyd Clapp, grew up in Holland at the same time as Anne was writing those diaries. After his own successful diverse careers in Australia and New Zealand, Boyd now travels with the exhibition and joins us on Open House. Let's start with a picture of what life was like for you as a young boy in Holland before Nazi occupation.
Well, when I was 13 in 1940, and I remember before the war, my parents, my father was very active in the church as an elder, and after this, the Sunday morning service, they would sit around the table and they talk about the future. And I remember my dad and the other people say, "It'll never happen to us." Because it didn't happen in the first place.
Yes, Holland was neutral, wasn't it?
Holland was neutral, and Holland was not. But anyhow, one morning, the 10th of May, 1940, suddenly there was that hum in the air, and there were these planes, these Junkers coming over low, and the war had started. We knew the war had started, and of course, the only positive for me on the day as a young man was that the school was closed.
Room for celebration.
That's right. And of course, we did not realize what was going to happen. Even then, when they sat around the table, the gentlemen talking about things as they did, and they said it'll be all over in a few months. You know, this won't last long. There was no particular anti-German feeling at that time.
Okay. So, while not being welcomed, it was a fairly neutral response.
Well, the response was not neutral, really. People were offended that suddenly this free country was invaded.
I should imagine.
And was taken over. And to be quite honest, a lot of Jews committed suicide. They knew what had happened to them because there were a lot of German Jews who had escaped from Hitler. They had come to Holland. And when Germany invaded, they knew what the future was going to be, and a lot of them took their lives.
Others had gone into hiding, like the Franks had.
Yeah.
Your own family took a stand on this as well, didn't they?
Well, indeed. See, we had neighbors, and they were Jews. And the Jews were totally integrated, like different people are integrated in Australia today. And they had a young boy, and my parents wanted to take him. But they reported. But that was after the swastikas were painted on the windows were smashed, and we all started cleaning up those swastikas and helped them. But one day they reported, they never came back. So that, to me, is one of the reasons. I saw the huge discrimination and the killing and the Holocaust. And it happened also in my own family, in particular my wife's family. There was an uncle. He was more or less her father because her dad died very young. He gave her the love of books and nature. And he was caught by the Germans because he was part of an underground organization. He was tortured. They got him so that he could stand again and then shot him. So the final thing is probably also interesting, that the neighbors of my wife, they were pastry cooks. One of those Van Gogh type homes, those three-story things.
Beautiful.
They had to report. Of course, Jews didn't know that they were going to extermination camps. We didn't realize what was happening. But as they left, Saartje was her name, with her two little boys, and they came to my wife's mother to say goodbye. And my wife's mother said, "I'll take one of the boys who doesn't look Jewish, and I'll look after that boy until the end of the war." And Saartje said, "No, I want to keep my children together. But here is a ring to remember me." And that ring was worn by my mother-in-law, and then for many, many years by my wife. And my wife passed away last year, and now my daughter is wearing it. And I had all rings of my wife valued, and this was the least valuable ring, but it's the most valuable ring.
Yeah. Completely different reasons.
Yeah, for different reasons.
So, you're a young man. Your view of the world is very much being formed under the duress of war and the wanton discrimination of an entire nation around you. And you become part of the underground.
I did towards the end of the war. The first couple of years were not that bad. I mean, the Germans actually thought that we would cooperate because they saw us as similar people. But when they started arresting the Jews, in particular in Amsterdam, there was a general strike. And when this general strike came, I mean, you can't have a strike under a dictatorship. And, of course, the Germans
had to be quashed.
Had to squash it. Yeah. And that was the end of that. So that was the beginning of the underground, really, the beginning of the resentment, the beginning of the aggression against the oppressor. The underground didn't particularly want young people in their underground because they could boast to their friends. And, of course, the main aspect of underground is secrecy. And but in 1944, when Montgomery came northward and came to Arnhem, the Market Garden, he crossed the Rhine, he lost the battle. Now, the northern part of Holland, where I lived, we all thought it was the end of the war, and the Dutch flags, the red, white, and blue flags came out. People in the underground became known, but it was lost in Arnhem. And at that time, of course, the Germans knew exactly who was what. Okay. And a lot of these people were executed or were sent to concentration camps. So that's when I was recruited, because I was only 17, don't forget.
Yeah.
And that is very young. If I now look at 17-year-olds, the fact that you were there is just quite amazing that you are part of that. Probably an interesting story is that many, many years after the war, I was living in New Zealand, and down in Little Queenstown, which is a ski resort, I had a little house built because I'm a very enthusiastic skier. And there is a plumber working there. And I said to this guy, you know, where are you from? He was from Scotland, but he lived in Canada. And I said, that's amazing. And you're here. He said, yep. He said, where are you from? I said, from Holland. And he said, what city? I said, Deventer. He said, Deventer. He said, I was there in the Canadian Army. And I said, really? And he said, and I was there for a little while. I said, who are you with? He said, with the tanks. I said, well, there were three tanks rolling into the city, one near the railway base, and that was shot into flames, and another one came through the main street. And he said, yeah, that was me. And I said, and there was a bloke in blue overalls that climbed onto it who guided you into the city. I said, that was me.
You're not serious.
Yeah, I'm serious.
Isn't that awesome?
That's amazing.
And here's the man at the controls of the tank.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
Yep.
So let's talk about the Frank family. Describe for me the building for those who are new to the story, and how it is an entire family ends up hiding essentially in the cavity of a wall.
Right. Well, the Frank family were a German family, and as I said, I mean, totally integrated into German society. In fact, Otto, the father, was an officer in the German army in the First World War.
Is that right?
This just seems unbelievable, doesn't it? And the next thing, he is a non-human, a subhuman, because that's how they were treated. So what happened with the Frank family, and they were well-off business people, after the Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glasses, when the Nazis got into the streets, burned synagogues. So when that happened, quite a few Jews left. They were one of those families that went to Holland, which had been neutral in the First World War. And they thought they were going to be safe. And of course, as we said earlier, in May 1940, the Germans invaded Holland, and they were occupied by the Germans again. And for a little while, their life was normal, because it was step by step. The next step was they had to wear the Star of David with the word Jood on it, which is the Dutch word for Jew.
Yeah.
The next thing, they were not allowed to be in parks. The next thing, they were not allowed to be in swimming. But the next thing, they were only allowed to shop between 4 and 6.
And how quickly did this transition take place?
That was very quickly. That went over months. It was a step-by-step thing where slowly, slowly. And the other thing, too, is they all had reported. So there were registers of all these Jews, which meant that such a high percentage actually were killed in Holland, a higher percentage than in some other countries, because there were registers. They were known. They were being able to be found. Now, several things happened. Again, some committed suicide. Some escaped, but that was very difficult to come through the lines. You had to get either to Switzerland or to Spain. Mm. And you can imagine, with German occupation in all these countries...
And the Swiss were reluctant to take Jews.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, well, I think the sad thing, if you go back into history, is in the 30s, before the Second World War started, Jews wanted to go everywhere, and most countries said, no, we don't want you. Yeah. I mean, this is a very sad part of our history, actually.
It is.
But you see, so what happened at some stage, Otto, that was Anne's dad, decided that they were going to go into hiding. Now, he had, if people have been in Amsterdam, one of those very large Van Gogh-type homes, 3-4 stories, and the business was in front, and behind was accommodation. So what they were able to do is they were able to go into the accommodation, separated it out. It's a famous bookcase that was put in front of the door separating the two parts of the building, and that's where they were living. Now, just to imagine, they were not allowed to talk during the day because then it could be heard. Mm. They couldn't use the two toilets. They had the curtains closed. It was just oppressive. Only at night or during the weekends were they able to move around a little bit, and on the odd occasion even went into the factory area, but not very often.
And for those who don't know, how many people are living in this space?
Well, top of my head, this is the Frank family. That was Margot, her sister, mm-hmm. and that's four. And then there were six other people living there, older people, especially in the eyes of Anne Frank, and one young man. Of course, she fell in love with
him
because he was the only guy that was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then hated him.
And her diaries are full of girlish observations and yet at the same time a remarkable wisdom from the glimpses of life she was able to see through a window.
Yeah.
But she's particularly candid about her frustrations. Give me an idea of the space that these people were all living in. What kind of area was it in size?
It is just like a very small house. But the worst thing for her was that she had to share her bedroom with a middle-aged man, a dentist. And she didn't like him anyhow. So there she was with that man and then with the other people. And then because she was a teenager, she had the clash with her mum, you know, which comes out in the book to some extent, loved her dad. But it was oppressive. And the only thing she had, she would go upstairs and look through the window, and there was the chestnut tree. Mm. And the chestnut tree is very much part of the Anne Frank story because that was her life. There was spring. There were leaves on it in the spring, and the leaves fell. And she still felt through that as part of the outer life.
Of course, the Frank story ends badly.
It does.
They're taken away to a camp and they perish.
And at the end of the war, it was only weeks before that she perished. She was always optimistic. She was always positive. Even with all that happened, she said there is good in all people. You know, she saw the good in people. She was positive about the future. But she was a very sad person at the end because there are stories of people who met her right at the end of weeks before she died.
Boyd, you only joined the exhibition for a few months, and now many years down the track, you are touring the world with it.
Yeah.
Tell me about what the exhibition is and where it's been.
Right. Well, the exhibition really, Wayne, is a panel exhibition. It is not an exhibition with mementos or parts of her life, books or whatever it might be. It is a created exhibition of 11 panels. Now, you might think, panels, how can they really convey the story? Well, it has a timeline. It has a timeline with two parts. One is the history of the world starting in 1918 with the Treaty of Versailles and the crisis in Germany and the emergence of Hitler as chancellor. And he was elected, by the way.
Yes, very popular at the time.
And and then below that, you have the story of Frank. You see the Frank family in Germany. You see the Frank family in Holland. The story that we just talked about in the Frank house. And so the whole things are interrelated. Now, the interesting thing really is that you say, 11 panels. A lot of photos, a lot of writing, photos by Otto Frank, who is the only surviving member of the family. All of the others that were there died. The interesting thing is that people, you can hear a pin drop in the exhibition. People walk through it. We all know the end of it. We know the end of the book.
We do.
But you can hear a pin drop. And I've been to many of the exhibitions. I can tell you in a minute where I've been. But there's many a tear at the end. There's a lot of emotion in that exhibition. People really walk through it and live her life and then live her death at the end of it. 5 years ago, when it started in New Zealand, I was invited to be involved in an honorary capacity, formed a committee and et cetera, and sponsorships. It was for 3 months. It was in 18 museums in New Zealand over a three-year period. It attracted 200,000 people, 50,000 children, and Amsterdam was blown away by that success. And that's when they said, would you mind starting in Australia? It was a bit of a tall order, although I lived here for a number of years, a long time ago. But we got the support. We got the support from the sponsors. It's not easy in terms of a global financial crisis, but we did get support. And step by step, museums started getting involved. And the interesting thing is that at first they might say, is it still relevant? Or panels? If I could show you the letters from the museum, every museum says afterwards, it has been an incredible experience, or it's been the biggest thing that's ever happened to us. Bonavilla, this is Bonavilla, a small little town. You'd say, well, why do you take your exhibition there? They got 3,000 people through it. They just can't believe it. And they all say, could we have it back sometime, please?
Wow.
And, of course, I should mention, because that's more important, here in February last year, we started in the Holocaust Museum in Melbourne, and it traveled through the whole of Victoria that year. It was in Ballarat and in various other towns. We've now started in New South Wales by having it in the Sydney Jewish Museum, which in itself is a very, very
It's a moving space,
good museum.
Isn't it?
It's a fantastic museum, really. But it fits in well there, of course. It's there for 12 weeks. It started last week. And then it goes to Dubbo, Griffith, Newcastle. We're fully booked for this year already. And we are also booked to go into Canberra next year in February. I personally think that it'll run another 2 years.
To answer the question, what is the relevance of the Anne Frank story in 2014? What is your answer to that?
Well, to me personally, there are two aspects of it. One is democracy. You see, if you live under a dictatorship, as I experience, there is no free speech. You can't trust people. When I visited my wife for the first time, they were hiding a German Jew. Could they trust me? So they couldn't tell me. So trust, election, freedom of speech is a very important aspect. Out of Anne Frank's story comes that there is no freedom of speech. There is no elected government. All that doesn't exist. Second thing to me is discrimination. To me, and the same to my late wife, all people are equal, whatever their color, whatever their religion. And out of the Anne Frank story comes what starts with normal anti-Semitism, a form of discrimination, then develops into certain government controls, and it can lead to extermination of a whole race. And it wasn't only the Jews. It was the gypsies, it was gays, it was disabled people. In other words, those are the two main aspects. And I think discrimination, actually, we could focus on that because it's still very relevant. I'm just as upset about what happened to the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia or what might be happening in Syria today. In other words, the relevant is that we must learn from history.
Boyd Clapp, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Wayne.
Not one, but two inspiring stories, that of Anne Frank and Boyd Clapp, the chairman of the Travelling Anne Frank exhibition, and you can find more on that tour at sydneyjewishmuseum.com.au.